Hello and welcome to another episode of the County Cricket Podcast in association with our friends at Bear Cricket. I'm your host, Aaron, aka the Cricket Connoisseur, and joining me on my left for today's very special episode of the County Cricket Podcast is none other than dynamic Gloucestershire County Cricket Club middle order batsman, Tom Lace. So Tom, first things first, mate, thank you very much for joining me here on the pod today. How's your day been so far, mate?
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been good. Actually, been pretty quiet. Recovering from a slight interaction with COVID, which has been interesting, but I'm on the mend, and it's been a nice day so far. Just a bit of admin, so can't complain.
Fair enough, Tom. And of course, very, very glad that you have recovered fully from COVID right now. That is massive.
Thank you, yeah.
Massive tier. Yeah, it's not ideal, is it, to be honest?
Yes, exactly. And it's part and parcel of the game, I think, at the moment. You know, and as a county, not just myself, we were pretty lucky with it. I think we had one case sort of early on in the pandemic during the winter. So obviously it didn't affect us too badly. And, you know, with the boys away in the 100 and, you know, having a pretty small squad, it sort of came at a pretty bad time for the club, you know, with I think, you know, at one stage we had 15 pros and, you know, 15 were, you know, they were 50-50 whether they had to isolate or not with a couple of games left. And unfortunately, the Middlesex game was cancelled, which I thought was the end of the qualification. But the boys, you know, got it home and they managed to qualify, which was brilliant. And I watched the Surrey game on the sofa and, you know, it was a good game. Unfortunate to lose it, but, you know, Surrey are a good side. And it was a good competition overall, I thought, especially with everything going on and not many COVID cancellations. So I think it was enjoyed by all.
Absolutely, Tom. Yeah, definitely by us three here at the County Cricket Podcast. We absolutely loved it. Of course, we've got our final review show coming up this week after the Royal London One Day Cup final, listeners. You can, of course, watch out for that one on all of our social media platforms and, of course, the website. Cheeky little plug there. But yeah, Tom, I mean, it was borderline miraculous, wasn't it? Gloucestershire's qualification. Simon Harmer, of course, up at Old Trafford, scoring 22 in the final over. That got Gloucestershire into the quarterfinals. And then, unfortunately, four Gloucestershire fans did come to an end at the Oval against Surrey. Tim David, yet again, what a fantastic end to the tournament he had. But I'll tell you what, it was a very, very good campaign for Gloucestershire, and we will touch upon that as today's podcast progresses. But just for the listeners out there, today I'm going to be here talking with Tom about his early cricketing memories. Then, of course, we're going to be talking about Gloucestershire County Cricket Club. And then, you know how it goes here on TCCP. We do, of course, end today's episode with a classic round of TCCP teammates. But Tom, before we get into all of that good stuff, I want to transport you right back to the origin of the Tom Lace cricketing journey. So what are your first ever memories of cricket, either playing or watching the game?
Yeah, I think, when I was younger, I was actually a big footballer. And anyone who's, you know, any of the Middlesex, Derby or Gloss lads who've seen me in football warm-ups won't believe it. But I think at the age of 6 or 7, I backed myself. But in that sport, you know, there's so many people get, you know, plunged through the blender and, you know, you don't really stand a chance. So originally, I love my football and you know, I got to the stage in the summers where I sort of didn't really know what to do. There was no football to watch, no football to sort of play. And, you know, I used to go to the beach in Norfolk with my family, my mum and my sister and my dad. And I think it just started with my, you know, playing a bit of beach cricket with my grandpa. And, you know, I can't remember if I was batting or bowling or keeping. I was sort of doing it all and just sort of finding a love for it. And that included my great grandfather, a guy called Arthur, who's a real cricket badger, as they call them. And he was so much of a cricket badger, actually, at the point where I was born, he wrote a letter to Middlesex asking if I was eligible to play for the county when I was older. And he actually got a response from a CEO at the time saying, oh, you know, if he's eligible to play, if he's good enough, you know, all this, that, and the other. So at the point where I made my debut in 2019, unfortunately he'd passed away, but that was a pretty special moment. Putting the Middlesex hat on and, you know, knowing he'd be looking down very proud. That was a nice moment. I think, you know, I started, you know, the age group cricket in Middlesex from about under 10s. I made a lot of my good friends in the, you know, that period from about under 10s to under 18s. And, you know, came through the ranks with, you know, a lot of the guys who, you know, around the grounds, I'm thinking, you know, Zach Crawley, Ollie Pope, you know, played a lot of cricket against those boys. So it's nice to see those guys doing so well. And that's something that's a little bit surreal for me, actually, because, you know, I remember when these guys were, you know, Pope, he was just a little ginger thing, you know, you wouldn't a genuine 3 out of 10, and now he's actually half decent looking and churning runs. So it's actually, it's something that is a bit surreal, as I say. But and then just went through the ranks, played a bit of second team cricket when I was about 16 17. Sort of did okay for my first year. I think it's difficult when you're so young, because you're seeing all these, particularly bowlers, as my batter, you've got a lot of first class wickets who, occasionally rock up, and you think, oh no, I'm out of my depth here. But did okay in the years after, and got myself a sort of 6 month summer contract with a guy called Arthur Godsall, who I came through the ranks with. So sort of from there, I had a couple of good years of second team cricket with Middlesex, and got a very lucky break in that when Dave Houghton, the ex-Middlesex batting coach, was on his way to Derby, Ben Slater, who's now obviously at Notts, he was in the process of moving. So they were without an opening batter, and Dave Houghton was a big fan of mine. I was at a point in my career where it was probably stagnating a bit. I was sort of probably averaging 30 in the twos that year, opened the batting, and sort of thought, right, you got to switch on here, because your career could be going down the pan if you don't get a few runs. So in that regard, I was very lucky, because we rocked up against Kent for Derbyshire. I rocked up in Middlesex training kit. I had 10 guys who they had no idea who I was, because I hadn't played any first class cricket. And credit to them, they treated me like I had, and made me feel so welcome. I know it's cliche, but everyone says, oh, the lads have made me feel welcome and stuff. But in that environment, they were so good with me. I think of guys like Tony Palladino, Billy Godelman, Matt Critchley, Alex Hughes. Those guys are really supportive. And luckily, it was the flattest track of all time. I think Kent got about 500 in the first innings. I went out to open the bat against Matt Henry, and I was thinking, what's going on here? I think I got a couple of 40s in the game. And I think that's the sort of luck you sort of need, I think, in cricket. I think it's never going to be, a pretty straightforward journey. And I count myself very lucky, and I'm eternally grateful to David Houghton for sort of seeing something in me. And I think those couple of 40s are just the sort of confidence boost you need to think, I probably can do this. Finished the year at Derby. Went back to Middlesex in the winter, went back on loan to Derby in 2019, and probably did much better than I thought I would ever do, which was surprising and quite nice. It's the same again. I really, really enjoy my time there, and it's a place that I hold very close to my heart. Came back to Middlesex briefly, didn't quite work out, and then made the trip down the M4 to the glorious Gloucesters, where I am now, absolutely loving it. Not probably done quite as well as I would have liked just yet, but I think I've had a couple of performances which hopefully have, showed the fans what I'm capable of when I sort of switch on and tune in, a couple of performances that I can sort of take with me and take confidence from, to know that I can probably do it at this level. So that's my story so far.
Fair enough, Tom. And I tell you what, it's been some journey so far, and we have got a lot to unpack, of course, because three counties, Derbyshire, your home county Middlesex, of course, and your current county of Gloucestershire, three big counties in England and Wales. So I want to go through pretty much each by each, if we can, Tom. Okay, going through like highlights, key moments, this, that, the other. So I say we start with Derbyshire, because as you said, that was where you started your first class career. It's where you made your first class debut. In terms of the club itself, after spending all of those years with Middlesex, as you said, coming through the pathway, the academy ranks, what were your first impressions of Derbyshire County Cricket Club?
Yeah, it was a strange one. I mean, obviously, it's very different to Middlesex in the sense that obviously Middlesex don't completely own Lords. So a lot of the time you'd be training at Radler or Merchant Taylors or, various places around North London. But with Derbyshire, it was sort of completely the opposite. Everything was based at the ground. You had your nets out the back. It was very intimate and a lot smaller than Middlesex. And, that's something I really enjoyed about it. There was a select group of fans who I still speak to and check in with. They were brilliant with me for someone who wasn't actually, fully contracted there. They treat me like one of their own, and that really helped the process. Even in that first game, I look at our two overseas. We had Hardersfield Yearn, Big Saffer, and we had Lockie Ferguson. And that was, I remember standing at short leg in that game, thinking, I'm so glad I'm not on the receiving end of this. And, But no, it was it's as I said, it's much more intimate, but actually a very well-run club. So I felt the line of communication, very, you know, from the top all the way down to us as the players, you know, in terms of financially, you know, management-wise, everything was really clear, and it made it, you know, a whole lot easier for me to sort of know how the club is getting on and stuff like that. So
fair enough. Fair enough, Tom. And we always say here on TCCP, Derbyshire is very much a very tight-knit club. It does feel like a family, a community. I've always noticed that. I love my trips up to the Incora ground. And it is quite a nice little ground. I must admit, obviously not one of the bigger ones here in England and Wales, but yeah, still a nice day trip, I must admit, for us as Warwickshire fans. But in terms of your experiences at Derbyshire, Tom, how would you actually describe your spell with East Midlands County? How useful was it to you in terms of your progression as a professional cricketer?
I think to be honest, without that spell, who knows where I would have been, whether I would have, you know, still been at Middlesex, probably rotting away in the twos, just kicking and nicking them, actually, but no, I joke. But, you know, as I said, in 2019, the year I went back, I probably did, you know, much better than I would have imagined. And, you know, I opened the batting in the little period at the end of 2018 and did okay. Didn't get a 50, but got quite a few 30s and 40s. And yeah, I think I got 50 in the first innings of the year. Second innings of the year. What it was against Durham at the county ground. And then, you know, from there, I think I got a couple of 50s against Gloucester at Bristol, and then went back to Middlesex on loan for one game, which was bizarre. Sorry, not on loan, back to Middlesex because I think Darvin Milan was playing for England. So I literally went back for one game, then came back. It's pretty bizarre. So I played Leicester twice in 2 weeks, which is funny. But yeah, it was, you know, I think it was pivotal for me. And you know, I'm so glad that I did it, and you know, if I had my time again, I'd 100%, you know, do it, because, as I said, it's a very well-run small club, and you know, made me feel very welcome, and thankfully, I did pretty well out of it, and probably is part of the reason I'm here now, or a lot of the reason I'm here now, I'd say.
Well, I'll tell you what, Tom. Any Derbyshire fans tuning in, that'll put a nice big grin on their faces. That is a glowing review of the club. I must admit, rightfully so. I mean, they are a very, very nice club. I do like Derbyshire, as you may be able to tell, in terms of the way in which I've spoke about the club there. But in terms of going back to Middlesex now, Tom, I want to talk about your debut. Because at the start of today's podcast, you mentioned that lovely story of playing beach cricket in Norfolk and then with your great-granddad and the letter. I mean, that is such a fantastic, heartwarming story in terms of your cricketing journey. What can you remember from your debut for Middlesex, your first 11 debut, your first class debut for the Saxes? How momentous of an occasion was that for you as a London boy?
Yeah, it was massive. And I think it all happened pretty quickly. I remember I was playing club cricket in Derby on the Saturday, and I had a call from Angus Fraser, and he said, look, we're going to call you back for this week because, you know, we've got a few people. I think, you know, Paul Sterling was playing for Ireland, as I said, Darwin Brown was playing for England. And, you know, it happened pretty quickly. But I think because of the amount of time I'd played in the second team, and sort of the amount of, you know, I'd not probably done well enough to warrant a place in the first team at Middlesex yet. You know, simply because of the point where I was sort of just signed, they had a sort of God squad. It was a year they won the championship, you know, a lot of international stars, and you felt a long way away from the first team in that sense, and you felt a little bit separated from it. You know, just because there was probably five or six, you know, batters ahead of me to get into the first team. So you felt a long way away from it. But, you know, I was pretty nervous going into it. But, you know, the fact it was at Lord's, you know, the fact that, you know, Angus Fraser, you know, presented me my hat, and, you know, I showed him a photo actually on the day of when, you know, Middlesex under 10s, we won the team. I think they do it every year. They give it to the under 10s to try and, you know, give them a bit of morale for, you know, the season. And, you know, there's a photo of me, a little chubby kid with a Justin Bieber haircut, you know, just chatting to him. And, you know, and I said to him, you know, who would have thought, you know, this, how many, you know, 8-9 years down the line we'd be doing this. But, you know, and Angus Fraser, he's a great guy, and, you know, he was so supportive of me for my time at Middlesex, and, you know, he's you know, one of the good guys, and I think he's been really great for, you know, I know he's slightly changed his role now at Middlesex, but, you know, I think the club's in a better place with him around, and as I said, he was very supportive of us younger guys coming through. So but yeah, it was brilliant, and I got 50 actually on my first game in the first innings. And, you know, that was, I just remember when my mum was there, she, you know, she likes her cricket, bless her, but doesn't manage to come to as many games she probably would like. She's very busy with work, works extremely hard. And, you know, to have her there, you know, because my old man, he's come to a lot of games, so it was obviously good having him there. But I think particularly for my mum, that was a really nice moment for her. And, you know, it's the reason we played the game, you know, and I just, yeah, it was pure elation, really, when I got to 50, I think. And, you know, I was George Scott, who's now with me at Gloucester, he got his first class, he got his maiden first class 50 in that game as well. So that was, you know, it was a really nice moment where, you know, we sort of stopped and we sort of thought, you know, if you said to us 4 or 5 years ago that, you know, 4 or 5 of us guys would be all playing in the same game, you know, it'd be pretty special. So, yeah, it's nice to, you know, reminisce about it, really, because it all happened very quickly. I went back to Derby, but actually speaking about it now, it, you know, brings back some good memories and very proud memories. So, yeah, it was a really nice 4 days, actually.
Well, I'll tell you what, Tom, again, lovely's here. Really, really is. And what a story as well. Again, boyhood club, raising that bat. I mean, what was that moment like? You mentioned there already your family was there, but to think of all the sacrifice, the physical, the mental sacrifice as well. The game of cricket is very, very tough and very demanding as a sport. But what was that moment like? I know that it obviously would have been a bit of a whirlwind, but if you can kind of sum up the emotions in that moment, Tom, how would you go about describing it?
I think, yeah, it was as I said, it's obviously a massive sense of pride. But obviously there's a lot of relief there as well. I think, you know, you big up, you know, you thought about this for years. It's something you've always, you know, wanted to do since you picked up a cricket bat. So I think at the point when, you know, and I actually remember I didn't actually bat very well. I think I definitely used both sides of the bat, batting with the polo. But you know, looking back on it now, I couldn't care, frankly, because, you know, I think that's now a memory that I can really look back on and be proud about, because, you know, I literally played one game for Middlesex, and, you know, got 50 in the first innings, and then I think Chris Wright nicked me off in the second, which he's actually getting the hang of doing now. So I've got to try and negotiate him from now on, because it's getting on my nerves a bit. But yeah, it was massively, you know, massively proud. And as I said, I think it's what it meant to, you know, my family and the people who knew me, you know, my close family and friends know how important it is to me. So, you know, had loads of nice messages, and I think it was one of those things that I didn't, you know, until you sort of stop and smell the flowers, you don't really process it, because at the, you know, at the moment you're sort of going out there and making your debut and whatever, it's, you don't have time to sort of process it all. So I definitely look back very fondly now about it, for sure.
Fair enough, Tom, as you should. Absolutely fantastic. Really, really was. I mean, you say you're getting lucky, but I'll tell you what, in cricket, you make your own luck. Simple as that. So
exactly.
It was written, shall we say. It was fate. It was destiny, potentially, to raise your bat in what actually turned out to be your Middlesex first class debut. But in terms of the Saxes then as a club, Tom, if we're looking at it retrospectively, so all of those years spent with the London club, your boyhood team, what would you say was your favourite moment? Would it have been that 50, or was there another moment which, I wouldn't say tops it for you, but would also be up there in terms of a career highlight with the London club?
Yeah, I think, you know, I had a lot of time in the second team to play with, you know, people that I would call, you know, my genuine mates now. You know, I think, look, you play with a lot of people in cricket, but, you know, I'd, you know, those guys, you know, I can think of, you know, Robbie White, Ethan Bamba, you know, Martin Anderson, you know, the list goes on, Tilan Wallalawita, all those guys. You know, watching them come through and do well, you know, whenever I'm checking scores, I love to see those guys do well, because I know, you know, like, you know, the sacrifice that, you know, I've made when I got my hat, my cap from Middlesex, you know, I know the sacrifices that those guys have made and continue to make. So, you know, just the constant process of those guys doing well, as long as it's not too well against the Glorious, obviously, is very rewarding, you know, and it's something I enjoy. But no, I think, you know, getting your cap presented by, you know, Gus Fraser on a sunny day at Lord's at the Home of is probably hard to beat. I think when I look back, I think certainly that's the one that I think, you know, that's very special to me. So I think that'll be the number one for me.
Fair enough, Tom. Yeah, I mean, you put it quite nicely there, to be honest. At the Home of Cricket, getting your cap from your boyhood club, doesn't get much better than that, does it, to be honest?
Nah.
It's what we all dream of. It's what we all dream of as County fans. I always say this, though. I mean, for me, Warwickshire, would I want them to give me a cap? Because at that point, they must be really, really desperate for players. So maybe it's not quite my dream. But who knows?
You say that, you never know. You never know. We all peak at different times. Ryan Higgins didn't start bowling until he was about 18. Look at him there.
That is true. That is true. But I think I've reached my peak. I took 4 for 20 the other week. kicked on with some absolutely disgraceful off-spin bowling, but we'll have to wait and see. I'm not keeping
doesn't
my hopes
say
up.
That on the scorecard, though, does it? Just says 4 for 20.
That's true, but inside your heart, you know those filthy off breaks that somehow got wickets on that day. But we aren't here to talk about my bowling, fortunately, Tom. Otherwise, we'll be here for about 5 minutes on today's podcast. It's a shame. I think the listeners will be happy and glad for me to move on. But talking of moves, I suppose, Tom, we have to talk about your move to Gloucestershire. Of course, a county again, which I really, really like. I like Gloucestershire, I like Cheltenham, I like Bristol. It borders Warwickshire, so it's not that far away in terms of an away day. But how did that move actually materialise in the first place? How did you move from the Saxes to the glorious Gloucesters?
Yeah, so at the point I finished my second year at Derby, I was coming into my last year of my contract at Middlesex. And I'd had such a good time at Derby and enjoyed it so much. I was pretty sure that I didn't want to sign an extension with Middlesex because, you know, I felt, you know, I just felt, you know, at that point, just playing, you know, was the number one, you know, thing for me. Because I'd had, you know, I think in, I'd come off the back of probably 800 odd runs in the championship before I broke my finger. And I just thought, you know, I don't want anything to stagnate, sort of my progress here. So, you know, I just want to play. And after, you know, back and forth with Middlesex, they eventually, you know, offered a contract with, you know, a certain clause in it, which was, you know, with a certain amount of game time. And it was the, and it was the time when it was just the COVID year. So when it first came back in and played a few of the preseason games, didn't go particularly well. And then I got dropped for the first game against Surrey, which, you know, it hit me pretty hard. And that was, I think it's when you're surprised by something. And that was the first time that in my career I'd really been shocked and sort of felt not lied to, because I don't feel that there was, you know, any lying purposely going on, but I felt like I'd sort of been, you know, forced into signing a contract that, you know, I felt like I warranted a place in that side based on the previous year's performance. You know, and I'm not someone that, you know, toots my own trumpet or, you know, backs myself massively. So, yeah, that just hit me quite hard. And it was at that point I sort of thought, you know, London's also a very expensive place to live. And I was at a time where, you know, my parents had separated. So, you know, when I was, you know, I was living in a flat in North London, which is not a particularly nice area. So I felt like my sort of life outside of cricket was, you know, I felt like I was, because the house we're living in was owned by Middlesex. So I felt very sort of defined by my cricket. So I think at that point, you know, I just wanted a fresh start. You know, I wanted somewhere where, you know, Bristol's an amazing place. I'd spent a little bit of time here previously, but, you know, if I was going to have, you know, issues with my cricket, and, you know, you have more bad days and good days playing cricket. But yeah, I wanted to make sure that outside of all my cricket, I was happy, you know, I was stable, you know, I had my own place to live. And as I said, Bristol's a great place. So, and I knew, you know, I chatted quite a bit to Richard Dawson in the previous years, because when I broke my finger badly, it was actually against Gloucestershire. I was at catching square leg to Logan Van Beek, and James Bracey was blocking him back. And then he sort of had enough pull went at me, stuck a mitt out, and, well, it was horrible, actually. My finger was hanging off. And, you know, I had a lot of nice messages from the Gloucester boys. And, you know, I remember Josh Shaw and I, he was bowling around the wicket, short balls at me, giving me the barrage. And, you know, he sent me a message after, just checking in. And, you know, it gave me a really good sort of first impression of the glorious. And yeah, so as I said, it's another thing, you know, cricket happens very quickly. I think I was, you know, the time when I signed my contract, I was playing against Glamorgan probably 2-3 days after in Cardiff. So as I said, it happened pretty quickly, and it was a move that I made for my, you know, my well-being rather than, you know, cricket opportunities, because I feel like, you know, the opportunities will come if you're playing well. If you're not, you know, you get dropped, and that's the sort of cycle of it. But, you know, I just wanted to, you know, be stable and, you know, be in a place where I knew I was happy. And so far it's definitely been like that, which I'm very thankful for.
Well, I'll tell you what, Tom, I respect that immensely. I really, really do. I mean, having to make such a tremendously difficult decision, your boyhood club, Middlesex, you've grown up in and around London pretty much your entire life. And to make that move, as you said, to pastures anew, a fresh start in the West Country, I mean, it must have taken a lot of courage to actually do that, I suppose, in the first place. It's a massive uprooting, I suppose, for you. And you mentioned there about well-being, and this is something that I wanted to touch upon and really expand upon in today's podcast, because this is something you've spoken quite openly about on various platforms, Tom. What do you think is the key for cricketers in terms of maintaining their well-being? Because as we know in this sport, it's very, very cutthroat. It's very ruthless. You just mentioned it there. At any moment, your whole career could come tumbling down. An injury, you could get released. We see it so, so often in the county circuit, for example. A player has one bad season. That could define your entire career. And then you've got to find a different, you know, job set. So how do you maintain that well-being as a cricketer? Do you have any tips or advice for anybody in this, you know, this profession, I suppose, for maintaining that healthy mental state?
Yeah, no, it's a massive thing, I think, you know, and I think I'm glad that it's, you know, becoming, you know, much more at the front of conversations now. Because I think, you know, it's going to be different for everyone. I think everyone has slightly different, you know, worries and anxieties around cricket, and you know, some may be on worried about time in the game. You know, they've got to say someone's got 2 years on their contract. Feel like they've got 2 years to, you know, perform before, you know, who knows what happens after that. You know, there's a, you know, as we touched on before the, you know, the podcast, you know, the social media thing is also massive now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's, you know, not something that should be avoided now, because it's become a massive part of not just sports people's lives, but everyone's lives. And, you know, you're always in the limelight now. So you've got to, you know, find a way to manage that. And you know, it's, for me, what's really helped me is, you know, I've thought, you know, I think I've got 2 years after this year left on my contract, and I'm finishing off my university degree. So it coincides with the time I'm finishing, or my contract finishes, because, you know, I think if you can be at the point where you think you may, you know, who knows what's going to happen. As you said, you can get injured, you can perform poorly or whatever. But being in a position where you're completely ready to almost leave the game at the point, the next point where it's possible, I think has been helpful for me. And, you know, what I always say to myself is, you know, if I look back in, you know, how many years time, 10, 15 years, might be 3-4 years, who knows, when you're at an office job, and think, you know, I'll kick myself if I didn't play with the freedom, you know, I really wanted to have. And, you know, obviously as a batsman, you put a massive, you know, value on your wicket. And, you know, if I look back, you know, on my career down the line, you know, I want to think that actually, you know, you sort of left nothing in the tank, and you played with freedom and you were relaxed, which, if I'm honest, I haven't quite mastered yet. And I think that's something I'm really working hard on, because I feel like, you know, I think anyone who's playing county cricket is probably technically good enough. Mm-hmm. I think that to take you, you know, to that next level and be able to perform consistently and, you know, well, I think is, for me, is the mental side. So I think, you know, working on my mindset and, you know, as I said, really finding peace outside of cricket, I think is massively important for me. And it'll differ from person to person, you know, what motivates someone, you know, what, you know, stops those sort of worries and, you know, anxieties is different, you know, for each person. But as I said, I'm massively prioritizing it, and I have done for the last year or so. And, you know, I'd urge people, you know, not just in cricket, but, you know, in sport in general, if you do feel like you're, you know, struggling, particularly outside of cricket, I feel like if your performances are then, you know, you're taking them home with you, particularly if you live, you know, by yourself or whatever, I think it's really good to prioritize that. And yeah, and it's something I'm sort of enjoying doing, just exploring it.
Well, I'll tell you what, again, very, very admirable, Tom. And again, I respect the fact that you're so open about it. As we mentioned here on the podcast before, it's good that we can actually talk about these, well, I suppose these issues a lot more openly now, because it is massively important. And we're seeing this a lot more in sport, not just in cricket, of course. We've seen Ben Stokes, for example, take a break. Simone Biles during the Olympic Games took a break due to mental health concerns. It is something which affects sports people very, very frequently, even if some people aren't very open to admitting it. But the fact is, all of these pressures, these strains, these, you know, these issues that affect sports people, they do all congregate together and they produce so, so much pressure. And we mentioned it before the podcast, Tom, as you mentioned about social media. I, for one, love social media in terms of, you know, the interactivity you get. We wouldn't be doing the podcast without social media, for example, today. I messaged you on Twitter. Yeah. And for those who know our Twitter account, yeah, I do have quite a bit of fun running it. But at the same point, even as much as I love social media, I can acknowledge there is a dark side to it. Not everyone is going to, you know, utilize social media for good reasons. They're not going to use it to express certain opinions. They're going to use it for malicious intent. And for you, Tom, as a cricketer, I mean, there was quite a well-documented one, wasn't there? I can't exactly remember the framing of the tweet, but someone started giving you a bit of stick on Twitter, I believe it was, and Gloucestershire's captain, Chris Dent, came to your defence, which, again, I really did rate. I think we mentioned that on the podcast, actually, and saying how much we respected that. How do you deal with the pressures and strains of social media as a cricketer?
Yeah, I think, obviously, you know, I this is why, you know, I look at footballers and I have a huge amount of admiration for them, because they sort of have, you know, this on a huge scale. But yeah, I think that was a, you know, that was, it was a time that, again, at Surrey, where I had the incident with Middlesex, where, you know, I just, it was in that same room and I was like, oh, and I got pair in a day at the Oval. And, you know, I remember thinking, oh, you know, that was probably as low as I've felt in terms of mentally playing cricket. I think, you know, contributing zero runs and batting twice in a day is a particularly bad feeling. Even if you're, you know, facing Sean Abbott and, you know, you get a couple of good balls, which are, you know, I did, it still hurts massively. And I remember there was this guy I blocked on Twitter at the start of the year. I think I played Surrey at Bristol. I think I got 60 odd in the first innings, and then shock, I got naught in the second innings. And I came off and I checked my phone and some guy had sent me a little duck gif on Twitter, and I thought, had a little laugh or whatever, and I blocked him because I thought, you know, he's had his fun. This is the sort of thing that is not helpful for me. It's not constructive. It's not, you know, all it's doing is making me feel crap about myself. So still blocked and whatever. And then, you know, thought nothing of it. Got to this over game, got, you know, a couple of ducks in a day, which, you know, I put massive amounts of pressure on myself already. So you can imagine how I was feeling. And then someone brought to my attention this tweet from this guy this is the guy who sent the duck who I'd blocked. And it was along the lines of something like, you know, I've never known why Tom Lace has blocked me, never said anything about his ordinary career at Gloss Cricket, whatever. And I just thought, like, hang on a sec. Like, I don't know what I've done to, you know, offend this guy so much, whatever. And, as Denty said in the tweet he responded with, was, you know, I work very, very hard and I take it so seriously. And, you know, I want to do, you know, well more than anyone. So the fact that this guy's had such a strong opinion, not just on me as a batsman, but he, you know, I think he was calling me arrogant, or he said modesty's a gift or something. And I thought, what the hell's going on here? And I showed Denty and I was like, what do you reckon? And he was like, oh, for goodness sake, you know, whatever. And I just, because he, as I said, he's a massively supportive figure, and someone I feel very lucky to be, you know, playing with and, you know, be alongside with in the dressing room, because I've got a heap of admiration for him. Anyway, I get home and I see this, you know, at this point I deleted Twitter because I just thought, right, I need to find a way of managing this, because it's obviously an issue. You know, the more you play, the more you know, in the limelight, the more you've got to manage it. And anyway, you know, I think it was my mum or someone had seen the tweet, and she said, oh, have a look at Denty's tweet. And I saw it and I thought, you know, at that point I look back on that sort of whole incident, whatever, because Denty's tweet got quite a bit of, you know, response. And I think it struck a nerve for quite a few people, you know, across the counties. I think people sort of realise that actually there is a whole lot of negativity now on social media. And, you know, cricket, it's not like you play cricket, you're a celebrity, you're not famous. You know, you're as normal a person as, you know, you can be. So you are going to have your notifications on, you are going to, you know, be accessible. So I think actually that as an exercise was very positive for me, because it made me really think about how I manage it. And then also to have Denty, you know, tweet what he did in response, made me feel massively, you know, loved and supported, particularly by, you know, the club captain, who I don't think he got many runs that week either, you know, so for him to put his neck on the line and do that was, you know, it was brilliant. And as I said, I look back on it, it's probably, you know, it's more positive for me than negative, because of, you know, how I respond to that sort of stuff and you know, because of Denty's response.
Well, Tom, that is a very, very positive way of looking at it, to be honest. It really is. And as I said, I mean, it was pretty extraordinary of Chris Dent to do that, I must admit. And I give him a lot of credit for that as the club captain, leading by example. And as you rightfully said, I do think it struck a nerve, not just with county cricketers, but people in general. Like, the fact is, we do see cricketers. And I think now of the last week, for example, with England versus India. And there's all of these things, you know, being aimed at Dom Sibley, for example, someone who I've been watching at Warwickshire since 2017, and people just bombarding his mentions, saying he's the worst England player ever. He's useless. He can't play a shot. And for me, as someone who's watched Dom Sibley, obviously in the Surrey days beforehand, but firsthand, live in the flesh, not just at Edgbaston, but working and toiling away for hours in the Edgbaston nets. To see that constantly and people tagging him and atting him and mentioning him, it is absolutely awful. It really is. Yeah. I mean, once you go to an international stage, it must be 100 times even more amplified, mustn't it? As a cricketer.
Exactly, yeah. And we, you know, we had, you know, I look at, you know, Bracey, when he had a couple of games in the England side, and, you know, didn't go to plan, as, you know, he'd be the first to admit, because, you know, he's a proper professional gun player, and, you know, it happens in cricket. And, you know, some of the stuff I saw on Twitter as a friend of his, you know, it really hurt me, because, as I said, I know how hard he works and how everyone else works. So, you know, that point, again, that was the point where I thought, you know, I'm just going to, you know, get rid of Twitter for a bit and just sort of refresh, because there's a, you know, as much as people allow their opinions, there's also, as you said about Sibley, you know, he's clearly an unbelievable cricketer and he's done it for a considerable amount of time. So if you, it's to call him, you know, the worst, whatever, is just absurd and it's nonsense. And I think that's the thing you've got to realise as well. A lot of it is just nonsense. And if you bumped into, you know, a bloke in the pub who said that, you know, you wouldn't give them the time of day. And I think it's just because it's online and it's sort of, it's so accessible, doesn't mean it's got any logic or sort of wisdom to it. But yeah, you just got to be so careful. And that's the thing that, you know, scares me a little bit about international cricket is, you know, the amount of scrutiny, you know, you're under from ball one is massive. And I've got a whole heap of respect, you know, for the guys who do it week in, week out, and you know, continue to perform under that pressure. And it's something I definitely aspire to have eventually.
Of course you should, because England is the pinnacle. It's what we all want to achieve, isn't it? As cricketers, cricket fans, in particular county cricketers. I mean, when you think how many players have played for England over the years, in theory, anyone in that county circuit could make it. All it takes is one breakthrough season and you could be donning the three lines and a crown. But as you said with Bracey again, that was another really frustrating one. He was one of our first guests here on the podcast. Lovely bloke. Absolute yeah. Heart of gold. Humble, modest, really hardworking, scores runs for Gloucestershire. And then he's playing out of position as a wicketkeeper batsman. Because of course he's not going to say no, is he? He's James Bracey. I mean,
exactly right.
It's the dream. You want to play for England. It's his dream. He was the first Gloucestershire player since John Lewis in 2007 to represent England. They could have had him batting at 10 and he would have done it, because he's that kind of bloke. And then you have people who have seen him for two games against the likes of Tim Southee, Neil Wagner, Trent Bolt, Carl Jameson, some of the best bowlers on the planet, and have judged him now for the rest of his career. And I think that is completely, completely unfair. And Tom, I mean, this is something which I've been mulling over, actually, in the past few days with the Test match, looking at the likes of Dom Sibley, Sam Curran, for example, as well, who got a king pair in that match. Do you feel at times that people on social media almost want cricketers to fail because they want to be proven right? Because for me, I've noticed that quite often now at the moment. There does seem to be some people peddling an agenda against certain cricketers on social media. That's just my personal two cents on it.
Yeah, I think with the 100, and you know, I think the growing sort of cricket audience, I think, you know, with everything, I think, you know, it's becoming very similar to football. I think, you know, people, you know, you look at some of the, you know, because I'm quite a big Chelsea fan, so you know, I sort of have to catch myself occasionally with, you know, I'll you know, one of the Chelsea players will play badly and I'll go, oh god, he's rubbish or whatever, and I think actually this is the same thing, but on a slightly different scale. And I think with footballers, you see them as this sort of superhuman, like, you know, untouchable breed. But, you know, at the end of the day, they're people, they've got families, they've got kids, and it's the same, you know, it's the same stuff. And I think, you know, but saying that, I've never gone on Twitter and, you know, out these people. And I think as a, in general, if I had one challenge for the human race, which I know I can't just do, but, you know, I would urge people just to try and be as positive as they are negative. And, you know, there was a petition I signed the other day, which was, you know, ID verification on social media accounts, which I think should be a given, particularly on Twitter. And I think to be held accountable for your opinions, particularly if those opinions are in any way derogatory, which obviously we saw with the England football team. Everyone's happy, well and good. It's coming home, drinking beers and stuff. And as soon as a few lads miss penalties, you know, it goes to absolute rubbish. And, you know, that accountability, I think, is massive. But I do agree. I think people have opinions and agendas. And, you know, if certain players not doing well suits their agenda, that's obviously slightly, you know, fuel for them. But I think you've just got to let that sort of group be, to be honest. I think, you know, that you can't stop, you know, people are allowed opinions, and, you know, there's a reason they're where they are, you know, paying their Sky subscriptions to watch guys like Sibbers, Bracey. You know, they're sitting on the sofa, guys are out there playing for, you know, cricket at the highest level against quality bowlers. There's a lot in that as well. You know, there's a reason that they're on that side, and, you know, these guys are putting themselves under huge amounts of pressure week in, week out, and, you know, a lot of the time performing. So, yeah.
100%, Tom. And I'll tell you what, that's something that I've learned actually over the years as well with regards to social media, in particular Twitter, because I never used to use Twitter. I only actually came onto Twitter in 2019. It was something I always avoided because, let's face it, as someone who does like Twitter and enjoys the platform, there is quite a lot of toxicity on it. It's just part and parcel. Mm. It's part of the fun, I suppose, with the platform. But I did notice this because I have a pretty bad mix of sports teams when it comes to supporting in terms of emotions. I'm an Arsenal fan.
And okay, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Any Arsenal fan can relate with that one at the moment. And we're playing Chelsea at the weekend. So again, probably not going to be the best result for the Gunners. And then the other team as well, RCB. I've supported the Royal Challengers Bangalore since the first ever IPL. And yeah, 13 seasons of hurt, heartbreak and despair later. And you do realise this because I used to be one of those who, not on social media, but would be very, very critical of players at times. They have one bad game and suddenly it's like they deserve to be dropped, this, that, the other. And then as soon as I started getting into the world of cricket and speaking to cricketers, speaking to people involved in the game, and you do realise there is that human element. At the end of the day, once they go away from that game, they're just going to be as downtrodden as you are. They're just going to be as hurt. Yeah. They're going to be as disappointed, as gutted. But for them, I suppose it's amplified even more because they haven't just got my opinion. They've got the opinion of all the fans, which is now bearing weight on them as well. So it is something that I feel like we as fans need to understand as well. And it's something which I think you've conveyed very, very well, Tom, is that expectation. And it's also the fact that there is a human being behind that social media avatar. And it's something which we do 100%. Need to realise and take some accountability for and work towards in the future.
Yeah, and Hector Bellerin, I listened to he was speaking at, I think it was either Oxford or Cambridge, and he was speaking about, you know, he's a very interesting guy, Hector Bellerin. And, you know, he's one where I sort of, you know, sympathise a little bit with because he's been on the receiving end of his fair amount of abuse over the years. But, you know, very interesting guy, you know, he's a cool guy, you know, he wears cool outfits, you know, he's a really interesting character. And he was talking about it at its worst and how, you know, it was getting to a stage where he was searching his name into Twitter after he had a good half to see, you know, how he'd gone. And it just shows that, you know, even guys like him who, you know, millions of followers and, you know, massive following through the Arsenal fan base, you know, they're trying to find that, you know, justification that they've played well or whatever. And, you know, all it takes is, this is why I think as a sportsman, you've got to stop looking at it because, you know, I could see 10 positive things about myself, where it'd be someone say, oh, he's very talented, you know, young player, whatever. And it might be one old bloke on his, you know, armchair typing, oh, he's rubbish or whatever. And that will have a much more of an impact from the other 10, even if those 10 are from genuine sources, I know journalists, whatever. And, you know, but that chat from Hector Bellerin is really interesting. And I'd urge anyone sort of thinking about how they approach it to give it a listen because it's very interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have watched that on YouTube. And funnily enough as well, you just mentioned Arsenal, I'll mention Chelsea now, Kepa. He wrote an article, I think, for the Athletic, I think he wrote that for, in terms of the Carabao Cup final and his mentality after that. Yeah, as I said, I mean, as soon as you open your eyes to it, as a fan, you do realise and you do think before you make that tweet or you make that Instagram post or this, that, the other. And again, the key thing here isn't about not having an opinion because we all have opinions, we all have agendas. And the fact is as well, criticism, as much as we like to block out every single bit of criticism, constructive criticism at times can be incredibly useful. Exactly. I know from firsthand experience, in particular on this podcast, because if you listened to us a year ago, you'd think this is the Warwickshire County Cricket Podcast, as opposed to the County Cricket Podcast. I mean, my bias was absolutely off the charts. I needed a wake-up call in order to tone it down a bit. So certain criticism can be fantastic. It's the way in which you convey that. And it's conveying 100%. It in a way which can be utilised in a positive way by the person on the receiving end.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
100%, Tom. So just before we move on to, obviously, this season, and then we go on to teammates, of course, a nice way to wrap up today's episode. Just one final thing about mental well-being as a cricketer, and that is, how do you maintain an even keel as a cricketer? Because it is difficult. When you said it beforehand, you have more bad days than good, in particular as a batsman, because you're going to have some odd dismissals. I think back to the other day, Dan Mousley against Somerset.
Oh, yeah.
Anyone's seen that? What a ridiculously unfortunate dismissal that was. Yeah. I mean, couldn't do anything about it as the ball trickled back onto his stumps against Somerset. But how do you maintain that even keel in the roller coaster of emotion that is the wonderful game of cricket?
I think, yeah, and it's, you know, it's something that I'm still sort of learning and working on, because I think when I started my career, particularly in first class cricket, I sort of started pretty well. So I sort of had that high expectation of myself from the off. But, you know, I think accepting that you're going to have more bad days than good days as a batter, particularly, but also bowlers. You know, I think I sometimes have to sort of keep myself in check, because I think, oh, bowling would be easy. You just run in and put it on a spot and just, you know, look at Rushy, just nips them everywhere. But actually, you know, there's a completely different, you know, mental side to that as well, in terms of, you know, consistency, things like that. So, you know, I can't speak from experience in that. And I imagine it's equally as hard as being a batter as well. But, you know, for me, I get my most enjoyment out of, you know, if I look back on a season, I think of individual performances where I feel like I've contributed to winning a game. You know, there was a game at Bristol where, you know, we were playing against Leicester and we were chasing, I can't remember what, 350, I think, on the last day. And, you know, Ian Cobain and I batted, and I think we had like a 230-run partnership, and we won the game. And you know, for me, that's why I play the game. And, you know, the point where I got out, I was gutted I didn't get 100. I think I got 97 hit on straight up. But, you know, I look back on that, and that's where I look back on my career, and they're the games that I want to remember. And I think if you can try and accumulate those, as you know, over a season in terms of match winning contributions, I think, you know, that's the way to go. And yeah, it, you know, it's tough. I had, you know, I had a horrible dismissal against Somerset, where I was caught down the leg side, but got nowhere near it for naught. And this was like, oh, you know, you feel like you've processed every way of getting out, and think, you know, when you get a stinker, it's like, actually, it's out of my control. I haven't really got out, and you're out. And then I got the next game. I got those two ducks against Surrey, played against Leicester, got dropped on naught. So I was looking at four ducks in a row, the Audi. And I thought at that point, it can't get much worse than this. So you might as well get out there, play with a bit of freedom, whatever. And yeah, it's amazing, this game, because it always gives you enough, you know. I look back to our last championship game against Hampshire. You know, I got 15, I think, in the first innings, and Carl Abbott, you know, hit me on the shin, as he does with a lot of people. And I thought, crikey, this is a tough game, this, because there's some good bowling coming in here. And then I got 100 in the second innings, and you think, you know, that's come from absolutely nowhere there. As in, you know, I'm not feeling massively confident. I'm not feeling, you know, overly, you know, confident that I'm going to go and get above 20, let alone, you know, 50 or 100. So I think, you know, what I took from that is, you know, you're only ever one innings away from getting back to your best. You know, I look at that, you know, when I nearly got Audi, I think I only got one as well. So I got one run in four innings, and I thought, you know, I feel as bad as I've ever felt here, but actually you're one innings away from, you know, either winning a game or contributing to a game. So, you know, you're never as far away as you think. And yeah, I think celebrating the good times and not being overly, you know, critical about yourself when it's not going well is important as well. But as I said, it's something I'm still learning and continue to learn. So, you know, and it's also something that Gloucester is a massively open conversation, you know, with, you know, guys like Denty, you know, Bracey, you know, Miles Hammond. We have a lot of these discussions about, you know, how we manage our emotions when we're getting out and things like that, which is brilliant, because as I said, I think, you know, everyone's technically good enough to be where they are. And I think that's the thing that's going to unlock, you know, the next level, particularly for me. And, you know, and I'm glad we can speak about these things.
100%. Yeah, they are a very, very good unit. I must admit, we like getting the Gloucester boys on. We've had Jack Taylor, had James Bracey on. I mean, we've had Ben Charlesworth on as well, funny enough. I think he was our most recent Gloucestershire guest. Ian Cobain, it's funny you mention that, because we do have the TCCP stroke of luck here. before that game, he hadn't played a single first-class game, I think, in a year. And that was his first game back, right, after recording our podcast episode. And he went and scored a century. So I'm just saying, Tom, if you suddenly get like a stroke of good luck in the game of cricket, you know why. It's because of this podcast recording.
But I could do with it, so yeah.
It is weird. It's very, very strange. It's very, very strange indeed. But yeah, fingers crossed, it does work for you as well, mate. But
yeah,
in terms of that knock against Hampshire as well, cracking knock, must admit, at Cheltenham. Of course, unfortunate for Gloucestershire not to go through, but still an excellent, excellent innings. Very assured, very composed, very, very good innings, I must admit. I think we mentioned it on our county championship wrap-up show, in fact, for the last round of games. That was round 14, wasn't it? I mean, oh,
yeah,
it's gone by very, very... It's mad, isn't it? 14 games of cricket gone. Oh,
yeah.
We're now approaching Super September. I know, it's strange, isn't it? It's very, very strange. Where's it gone? Where has it gone, Tom?
I know.
But in terms of my final question then, before we move on to teammates and wrap up today's episode, in terms of this season and beyond, Tom, what are your aspirations with Gloucestershire? Obviously, I'm guessing silverware will be massive, of course. Gloucestershire have got a very, very promising bunch of players, some fantastic names in there, and of course, trophies are definitely achievable. But is there anything that you really want to achieve from a personal perspective from your next few years with the West Country outfit?
Yeah, I just want to keep sort of doing myself proud. I know it sounds, you know, obvious, but, you know, I really love this club. As I said, it's another cliche, but, you know, I do feel very strongly about, you know, the players here, you know, great mix of young and old, you know, the coaching staff, how I've been, you know, welcomed and Bristol is a place. So, you know, this is a place that I, you know, want to make my home now going forward. And to do that, I've got to consistently, you know, put in performances, and then that contributes to us doing well. And, you know, as you said, you know, I've got a good feeling about silverware for the club, you know, even the T20s, which I'm not involved in. You know, I look at some of those games and got a massively talented side. And, you know, I just to keep putting in performances and like I said, those match winning performances, they're the ones that mean the most to me. And, you know, if I can put, you know, three, four, however many of those a year, where you genuinely think, look, it's all down to me. You know, you can have your contributions with 50s, whatever, but those sort of single-handed ones, they're the special ones. And, you know, if I can do that for, you know, for a long period of time, you know, I'd love to be at the club for a while. So, yeah.
Absolutely, Tom. And it goes without saying, you know what I'm going to say, but wishing you nothing but the very, very best of luck, mate. I've got absolutely no doubt you'll get out there, smash some runs, hopefully not too many against Warwickshire, if our counties do face off against one another. But yeah, wishing both yourself and, of course, Gloucestershire as a club the very best of luck heading into 2021 and, of course, the seasons beyond that. And talking of Gloucestershire, Tom, talking of Gloss, this is, of course, where the podcast takes a very interesting turn. And we do, of course, have our concluding part of today's episode, which is, of course, teammates. Now, for those who don't know how this segment works, basically, I've got a selection of questions in front of me here for Tom to answer about the people that he shares a dressing room with down in Bristol. So, Tom Lace, are you ready for TCCP?
I'm ready. Yeah.
That's what we like to hear. So the first question, I suppose, on today's episode then, Tom, and I think I know who this might be, but who's the teacher's pet down in Bristol? Who's always hanging around the coaches, per se?
That's a good question. Don't like to say it, but I'll say James Bracey.
There it is. Yep. Every single guest so far, all the way from James Bracey himself. He mentioned himself for that category.
Did he? Good on him. Yeah, I don't feel too bad then.
I think he said it. David Payne said it, Cobain said it, Charlesworth and Taylor. So there we go. Every single Gloucestershire player has said.
The undisputed.
Yeah, the undisputed teacher's pet down at Gloucestershire County Cricket Club. You heard it here first, folks. Moving on to our next one. Now, again, there could be a couple of candidates here, to be honest, Tom. But who's Mr. Hard as Nails in the Gloucestershire dressing room? Who wouldn't you want to mess with, necessarily?
I think Dent would be the one I wouldn't mess with. I think he's built like an absolute, he's a unit. He's a unit blessing. But also another one to add in the mix, Glenn Phillips, our overseas. Mm. He's a big boy as well. So I think those two, you wouldn't want to sort of go up against them. But I'd have to say Denty. But also for a nice bloke as well. I think normally the nice blokes get away with it in the who would you fight question. But I would hate to get on the wrong side of that bloke.
Yeah, Chris Dent, he's got some big biceps, I must admit. It doesn't look like it. This is the thing, when he goes out to bat, you wouldn't realise it. And then you see the Instagram, or you see like some post-match stuff, and it's like tree trunks.
Yeah.
Absolutely insane. Yeah, that
I think my mum mentioned it as well. I think she texted me after one of my early games saying, oh, I've seen Chris Dent's arms. I'm like, I have, actually, yeah. Thanks for that. Cheers. Cheers, mum.
Haven't we all? I think you can see them from space. That
yeah, exactly.
Absolute man mountain is Chris Dent. Good shout with Glenn Phillips as well, to be fair. Little bulldog, originally born in South Africa.
We called him, his nickname is the Dragon, just because he got out in one of our Rebel games against Leicester and absolutely lost his head. So from then on, he was the Dragon, which I think was a stepbrother's reference when he's, you can call me Dragon.
That's a good one. That is a very, very good nickname. Keep that in mind, actually. That may or may not ruin one of the upcoming questions. Okay. But in fact, I'll mention it now. Who has got the best nickname in the Gloucestershire dressing room? Dragon is a pretty good shout for Glenn Phillips. But
Dragon,
any other ones?
Yeah, well, there's a sort of new one that's developed recently. Then if you've seen this, a guy called Hasbulla on Twitter.
Oh, yes. The absolute little fighter. Legend. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's stuck to GV a little bit.
Graham Van Buren.
So, yeah, Graham Van Buren, yeah. So he's now Hasbulla, which is good stuff. He's you know, both little lads, both, you know, pretty decent units.
Scrappy little warriors.
Scrappy little warriors, yeah.
That might be the best nickname.
You'll hate the fact that I brought that up. Yeah, no, you'll hate that.
That might be the best nickname we've ever heard on the podcast. For those who don't know Hasbulla, he's a legend.
Yeah, absolute legend. Love him. That's the thing as well. It's laughing with him. It's not at him. It's just a couple of cuties, aren't they?
That's an honour. That is a privilege to be called Hasbulla.
Yeah. I know.
That is fantastic. That really is a good one, Tom. Fair play. It's better than just adding a Y on the end. We do.
That's the cricket thing, isn't it?
Yeah, like we do at Warwickshire. Roycey, Wokesy.
Yeah.
I mean, we have got Sibbers, I suppose. We've got the fridge. But, maybe.
Fridge. Fridge is good.
It is good. And the vicar. The vicar of Sibley. But moving swiftly on, because this isn't about Warwickshire, as many people listening in will tell me. So, Tom, moving on to our next question. Who is the dressing room DJ at Gloucestershire, and what are their go-to choices of songs?
I reckon that I'd have to say Frankie Worrell, who's obviously no longer with us. He's a brown hatter now. He's got a massive variety of music, that man. Real big mood listener. I think he gets a nail on the head for, you know, if we're for a couple down early, he sort of just tones it down a bit. And then, you know, if we're going all right, you know, slightly more upbeat. But yeah, he's a good DJ. But I find myself, I don't want to give him too much credit for it, so I find myself, you know, walking over to the speaker with my Shazam out quite a bit, you know, because I couldn't swallow my ego enough to ask him what the songs he's putting on are, because his head will explode. So yeah, he's good for a Shazam, that bloke.
Yeah, just the cheeky, get the app out, put it by the speaker. Happens to us all, I think. I've done that on plenty of occasions, especially with your mates who you say have got terrible music taste, and then they put on a banger and it's suddenly like, oh, I'm not going to say that you've
got good taste. Yeah, exactly, you go, right.
Gets or Snapchat out, the little Snapchat music filter on.
Yeah, jobs are good. I'd use it, actually. It's good stuff, that.
It is, yeah. There we go. Some life advice here from us to the Carrick Cricket Podcast. Those wanting to get the identity of a certain tune.
Top tip.
Hashtag TCCP, top tip. Moving on to our next one then, Tom. Again, very much musically themed here. Who's the karaoke king down in Gloucestershire?
There's a chance I've got to put myself on the line there, I think.
Ooh,
there's a little chance, yeah. I think we've had a couple of karaoke evenings where I've sort of, you know, I'll pull a bit of James Blunt out or, you know, something like that. And I wouldn't say everyone's speechless, but I reckon they'd be close.
Fair enough, Tom. Fair enough. In fact, I think you might be the first person to say yourself for that one. So that's quite interesting.
Yeah, well, that's mainly because I don't reckon there's many people that back themselves on the singing front. Again, Frankie Worrell would be good, I think. If I had to pick anyone, it'd be a good tag team, I think.
Duet. Make that happen. Gloucestershire versus Surrey. That should be class. Yeah. A little Tom Lace, Frankie Worrell duet. Singing some James
Blunt. For the points. If it gets rained off, just do it for the points.
Hey, ECB, if you're listening, make it happen. Make it happen, that's all I'll say.
Exactly.
Moving on to our next one, Tom. This one very much cricket-orientated. You're actually the first Gloucestershire player we've asked this to, so this should be interesting. Who's the most likely to get timed out during a game? Who's a bit slow getting the kit on, per se?
You know what? I think there's too many of us who have that recurring nightmare dream where you can't get your pads on quick enough, mm-hmm. and you go out to bat and then you've got no shoes on. I think everyone's pretty, you know, Denty and Charles, if they're always, you know, they're good to go. Bracey got his pads on. If I GV at five, he'd have his pads on. You know, I think we're all pretty safe from getting timed out, to be fair. I think it is that recurring nightmare that if you speak to any batter, they have consistently about, you know, the wicket falling and you're just not getting your pads on quick enough. And I think that just lives rent-free in everyone's head. So, yeah, I don't think anyone's getting timed out anytime soon. The one person I will say, actually, who, not from Gloucester, but I played, he was at Middlesex when I was growing up, Charlie Thurston at Northants. He waits for the wicket to fall to put his pads on. And it's actually really stressful to be around. So he'll be batting three and he'll be watching the first, or however long he's waiting, with his pads off. And he puts his pads on when he goes out to bat. And we played him in a twos game earlier this year. He was at three and I was still at slip and I turned around and Thurston just got no pads on. I thought, this is making me anxious. I don't know how he does it.
I don't get that at all.
I mean, he does. Incredible. Incredible composure.
It is, but I mean, living life on, well, I suppose a little bit dangerously. The other day, again, this is village cricket level, so take that as you will, but we had a couple of wickets fall really quickly. I was batting at nine, right? And I was thinking, geez, I've got to get my pads on right now. And there were still like two wickets remaining. And as you know, in village cricket, anything can happen at any moment. And I'm there getting my left pad on, one wicket falls. And then I'm like, okay, well, surely our batsman can stay there for another, you know, at least another minute. Just let me get my right pad on. Bang, another one goes and I'm next into bat. Haven't got my helmet on. Haven't got gloves on.
Oh, no.
Literally getting dressed on the way out to the middle. So,
no, that's too much, that. I couldn't do that.
I did get 11, though. So maybe it was actually quite...
It's not bad, that. It's a routine, now.
Exactly, yeah. Might be Charlie Thurston every single time.
Yeah, exactly.
Cards of bat. Yeah, channel the inner Charlie. Moving on to our next one then, Tom. This is a classic, and you are going to have to throw someone under the bus here.
Oh, no.
Who are the best and worst dressed in the Gloucestershire dressing room?
I'd say the best dressed is Miles Hammond. But that's a pretty unique school of appreciation. Like, he'll wear loose corduroy trousers, you know, like a oversized shirt and some shocking shoes, but it suits his personality. He's quite an eccentric character, so I think it goes with his personality quite nicely. So I'd say, in my opinion, he's the best dressed. And I think the worst dressed would have to be Ryan Higgins. And luckily, he is a dad now, but he's been dressing like a dad for the last 10 years, so he's pretty well equipped, I think, for the little one.
Fair enough. I think that is the first time, if I'm not mistaken, listeners, if you do want to correct me on Twitter later, I think that's the first time Miles Hammond hasn't been the worst dressed.
Well, that might say a bit about how I dress, maybe. I'm more sort of Miles Hammond school of rare, I think they like to call it. But yeah, I think people have got to be more open-minded with fashion. And I can imagine Payne would have said the same thing. Bracey would have said the same thing. Because it's the easy option, isn't it? And I think you've got to be comfortable to call out the blokes who wear dad jeans. And I'll do that.
Fair enough, Tom. Hey, each their own. That's the thing with fashion. I mean, I don't think I can really, you know, get into anyone's fashion sense. I just wear Adidas and cricket shirts, to be honest. But
that's why fashion is unique to everyone. So
it is, although mine could do with a massive, massive upgrade.
I'll put you in touch with Hammo then. I'll get Hammo on the next podcast. We can just do
Miles Hammond, if you're listening, wear something absolutely crazy outlandish outside of the box. Maybe I'll take some inspiration. Yeah. That'll be my next my next fashion choice. Moving on to our next one then, Tom. Oh, this is a classic one. Who's the dressing room joker down in Bristol? Who's always, you know, pulling practical jokes?
It's the Northern lads. This Jared Warner and Josh Shaw. Absolute mules. I do have to count my lucky star because I do find it very funny, but it's just relentless. You know, it's just every opportunity to try and mule you and have you on there, they've got you covered. you know, I can't remember, as an example, you know, it'll be a little thing. So someone asked me, I've got these little, like, this little Buddha head in my bathroom. And I think one of the lads was like, oh, that's quite nice. Where'd you get that? And I said, oh, I just literally got it from Poundland about 3 years ago. I was just in there with my mum. And he goes, oh, how much was that then? I thought nothing. Oh, it's pound. And he's like, oh, really? Was it? Oh, brilliant. And it's just it's relentless. And those two they're a rare breed, but I've got a lot of time for them.
Hey, fair enough. Fair enough. Funny characters, I must admit. Jared, we need to get him on the podcast. He seems like a very, very funny fella. And he does follow us on Twitter.
Comedy roadshow, that, but
fair enough. Yeah, get him on as a duo, like Morecambe and Wise.
Yeah. That's the Dumb and Dumber.
All that. I just didn't want to say it. Moving on
I don't know, I'll say it for you.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Moving on to our penultimate one then, before we get on to our final one, which is brand new for this week. Who's the best golfer down in Gloucestershire? Who's the next Tiger Woods in Bristol?
A lot of golfers at Gloucester, actually. George Scott, a very good golfer. George Hankins likes to think he's good because he's got a decent handicap, but he belts them absolutely everywhere. So if I wanted to play with a bloke to win, it would be Scott. He's plays quite boring brand. So he takes a lot of irons off the tee, you know, takes the percentage play. But yeah, he's a very good golfer. Very good golfer. And Payne's pretty decent. But yeah, I'd say Scotty's up there.
Yeah, I think the majority of our guests have said George Scott. Because again, it's more precision as opposed to just brute power, which I'm going to be honest is my golf game. Tom, what about yours?
Yeah, it's about that. I don't know where it's going. So yeah, happy days.
Exactly. I mean, with me, it's just drive and hope. That's how I describe my golf game. Zero short game. Wedges, irons, can't
no
use
touch.
Them. No, absolutely. I can putt. I'm good at mini golf as well. But now when it comes to, you know, the actual playing, the setup shot, non-existent, about as good as the old cricketing abilities in my case. Moving on to our final question then, Tom. And again, very topical, given the time of year that it is. We're coming to the end of summer. Instead of I'm a Celebrity, Tom, who do you say would be the most likely to appear on Love Island in the Gloucestershire dressing room?
Ah, it's a very good question. I think George Hankins he'd definitely back himself to be on Love Island. I'm not sure. I think he probably thinks his rig's slightly better than it is, maybe. And yeah, I don't know. I think he would think he could go on there, but I think he'd get slaughtered by the general public, which is a shame, but I try and convince him otherwise. But no, other than that, there's not many Love Island. I mean, Matt Taylor, I reckon he'd think he'd do a slightly decent job on there. He's a decent rooster. But yeah, I think Hanko, he'd definitely want to go on there.
Well, there we go, folks. We have our answer. ITV, if you're tuning in, get in contact with George Hankins' representatives.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think he's ever won it. Not that I would know, to be honest. I'm not exactly the Love Island connoisseur, but
no.
I'll have to wait and see. George Hankins, if you're listening, get in touch with ITV. Yeah. But Tom, I think that is a wonderful place to kind of wrap up today's episode, to be honest. And I must admit, it's been a very, very fascinating episode from my perspective personally. Just before we wrap up then, do you just have anything quickly to plug or promote? Any social media channels, for example?
No social media channels. I sort of like, as I said, I keep them all, you know, I think I'm private on Instagram now, and then Twitter I just have for a rainy day to just for the inner badger in me. But no, nothing to promote other than let's all be good blokes and girls on social media and be kind. That's all I've got.
Exactly, Tom. You know what?
If you can.
That is a very, very fitting way to end today's podcast, given the content. And fair play to you, mate. And of course, wishing you the very, very best of luck heading into the rest of this season and beyond. But that does bring us to the end to today's episode of the County Cricket Podcast. From myself and Tom, thank you very much, listeners, for tuning in. And as always, guys, we'll see you on the next one.